When Anthy returned, carrying a small bag over one shoulder and Makoto on the other, she found Utena knotting the ends of the sash neatly at her waist, just below the folded pouch where Annabelle was tucked securely against her chest, facing her. Corwin was standing back, looking impressed, while Jinora fussed with the details, precisely arranging the way the wide, many-folded fabric lay on Utena's shoulders and back. There's also a version of this method with which you can secure her to your back, which is useful if you need your hands free, and more comfortable for long stints, particularly once she starts to get a bit heavier, Jinora explained as she tidied up the folds over Utena's left shoulder. That's probably the one you and Corwin will be using most often, but I thought it best to start with this one. She smiled slightly. The other is a more advanced technique. Thanks, Jinora, said Utena, twisting her waist this way and that, then raising her arms a couple of times. All right? She asked Annabelle, who made a sound that might have been approval. Garnet coiled around Utrina's neck and draped her head over one of her shoulders, looking down at their infant charge. She seems comfortable enough. Are you sure this thing is safe? She's quite secure, I assure you, said Jinora. This technique has been used for thousands of years all over the world. Iki and I carried all our children this way, and never once dropped any of them, even when sorely provoked, she added with an arch little smile. She double-checked Utrina's knot. Good. There! Snug as a rabaroo, Joey. She smoothed Annabelle's violet hair with a kindly smile. Her first flight. That's a particularly momentous day in the life of an air nomad child. The elderly airbender kissed the infant gently on the head, and then, rather to Utrina's surprise, her bearer on the cheek. Then she wished them all a happy flight and departed. I guess she likes us, Utrina remarked to Annabelle. Then, turning to Anthy, she asked, So, how do we look? Anthy smiled. Very good together, she said. Then, with a slightly arch look at Corwin, she said, Defeated? I'll try again, have no fear, Corwin replied, smiling. Utena is better at textile management than I am, though. Anthy laughed. Ha ha ha! You should have known that would be the case, she told him. I'm sure she's told you about the time she made a dress for me out of a tablecloth. Corwin grinned wryly. I always assumed there was a bit of poetic license going on there, he admitted. Wait, did you just call me a liar? Utena wondered, eyeing him narrowly. No, Elsker, I called you a poet, he said, giving her a kiss. Besides, I'm driving, he added, making both women wonder briefly what that had to do with anything, before they realized he'd gone back to why he wasn't the one wearing the sling. Speaking of which, shall we? Corwin and Mogi led the way for the first leg of the trip, out over the southern corner of Republic City and to the Sato family estate in Future City. There they collected Ryo, who bounded out of the enormous manor house at the site of the bison landing in the courtyard, carrying with him a small tool bag of the kind used by surveyors and architects. Morning all, he said cheerfully as he clambered up Mogi's side. Reaching the top, he climbed over the gunwale onto the saddle platform itself, put down his bag, and grinned around at his fellow passengers. Good morning, Ryo, said Anthy cheerfully. And how's everybody doing to... Ryo paused, raised a thoughtful finger, lowered it, scratched his chin, and then said chidingly, Now, ladies, this is just not fair to poor old Ryo. Hey, don't look at me. She's the one who cheated, said Utena, angling a thumb at Anthy with a grin. You weren't complaining before breakfast, my love. Anthea replied serenely, making Uchina snicker and blush. All set back there? Corwin called from the pilot's seat. Corwin? Said Rio. Yeah? Corwin replied. Your ladies are very charming, but your daughter's mother, in particular, passeth understanding, said Rio matter-of-factly, drawing giggles from both. Ha! Tell me something I don't know. Mogi, yip-yip! From that point, Rohan took the lead. He guided the little convoy northeastwards, skirting Republic City's sprawling suburbs, then into the jagged and dramatic mountain range that ringed the city. Uchina, now sitting Indian fashion at the front of Mogi's saddle, smiled at the memory of the drive she and Corwin had taken up into these same mountains during their honeymoon, then glanced down to check again how Annabelle was taking the aerial experience. She was pleased to see that the baby seemed delighted, looking around as best a person could before she developed much in the way of command of her neck, with no fear or dismay in her emerald green eyes. Uchina was vaguely surprised to feel none of the misgivings she'd grappled with the previous night attempting a reprise. Being out here with an infant lashed securely to her chest was an utterly unfamiliar experience, and not one she had ever even daydreamed about having. But now that she was doing it, it just seemed right somehow. She still felt emotions she couldn't describe or catalog when she looked down at this tiny person's face, but none of them was alarming or disturbing. It was a very warm and pleasant experience, though she supposed part of the warmth came from Garnet, who had insinuated herself into the wrap as well, and was now, apparently less interested in the aerial experience than her human comrade, fast asleep. She wondered idly if this was what awakening maternal instincts felt like, and decided it probably wasn't. She still didn't feel particularly nurturing. That remained a task best left to people more qualified to undertake it. After mulling it over for a while, she decided that what she felt most was protective. She knew, of course, that mothers felt protective toward their offspring, too. Sometimes epically so, she well remembered Caitlin's nearly going on a rampage once. But there was a difference. She couldn't put a name to it right now, but nor did she feel she had to. She wasn't explaining it to anyone else, after all. Uchina shrugged inwardly and ducked her head to give Annabelle a kiss on the forehead. Okay, kiddo, she murmured privately to the child. I can do this. I'm not cut out to be a mom, but your father could be right. I might just be able to handle the dad thing. She didn't get an answer. It would have been more than a little startling if she had, but she liked to think that Annabelle didn't mind the idea. A moment later, she felt Anthea's hand on her shoulder. Turning, she saw her wife settling down alongside her with a smile. You look comfortable, she said, snuggling against Uchina's side. Is she enjoying her flight? Seems to be, Uchina replied. Sensing a change of course, she looked up and saw that Peavy was descending toward one of the mountains, with Mogi turning to follow him. Within a few moments, they had swept through a cut and were skimming over a meadow at the bottom of a short valley, the mountain's crags rising on three sides. Ahead, the valley ended in a jagged cliff face, down which a waterfall streamed into a small, irregularly semicircular lake. Peavy flared and landed near the rocky lakeshore. Corwin set Mogi down alongside him. Wow, said Corwin as he slid down from Mogi's neck. He went aft to help first Anthea, then Uchina descend from the saddle. Rio, his wits recovered, was so gallant as to hand them down from above, then jump down after them. Once regrouped at ground level, they all went around to join Rohan at Iki at the edge of the lake. This is amazing, Uchina agreed, gazing around at the scene. The mountain's gray-blue flanks rose all around them, rearing to snow-capped peaks to left, right, and center. They gave the valley a sheltered, secure feeling. It would only be approachable on the ground from the west, up the coombe that led to it, and even coming in by air from any other direction would be a challenge with that ring of peaks in the way. There was plenty of sunshine, though, the thriving meadow grasses and wildflowers, and the lack of snow in what was, after all, early spring in the mountains, attested to that. They were just below the tree line, with only a few hardy pines standing here and there. And yet, despite the site's splendid isolation, Republic City could still be seen, a distant blur of buildings and streets, down below, rambling down to the bayshore. Utrina guessed that it would be a blaze of golden light at night, far enough away not to be bothersome, close enough to provide a comforting sense of community. In the far distance, just barely visible, she thought she could even make out Air Temple Island itself as a speck on the blue arc of the sea horizon. "Not bad," Rio declared. "Min Min'll be jealous when she sees this. Our mountain retreat hasn't got anything like that view of the city." Rohan beamed like a magician who has just pulled off what he knows is a really good trick. "This is Mount Wei Tang, the Three Brothers," he said, gesturing around them. "So called because of its triple peak. Legend has it they were first climbed by three brothers from Omashu." Anthy smiled in recognition. "The Wei Tang brothers, great explorers from the time of the Western Emperors. I read about them in Avatar Jonghu's History of the Earth Kingdom." Rohan gave her a smiling salute and bow. "You're becoming quite a scholar of our history, Lady Anthy." "I have to congratulate you," Iki agreed, then grinned and added, "Not everyone has the stomach for the blessed Jongbu's prose. I never got through Volume 1. Utrina walked a couple of paces to the lakeshore, then turned and looked back at the Air Elders with a baffled look. "You're giving us this place? It's... real estate like this must be worth a fortune." "Oh, at least one," Rio put in. "I dare say it may be," Rohan agreed. "But we have little use for money. Jinora and I agreed, once we determined to grant the four..." "Five," said Garnet. "Five of you, one of the central air temple's holdings in the Republic, that it had to be this one. The other parcels we still hold are either too far from the city, too near the city, or so utterly inaccessible that not even we could make worthwhile use of them." "How did the Air Temple come to own such a place?" Anthy wondered. "Grandpa Aang was originally going to build Republic City's new Air Temple up here," Iki said. "It's a much more typical spot for one than the island. Eventually, though, he decided it was too isolated and grand. Would send the wrong message, like the Air Temple was meant to lord over the city rather than be part of it." "Some say Grand Grand Katara was the one who actually made that decision," Rohan put in with a little smile. Corwin laughed. "Ha ha! I'd believe that," he said, causing the two elders to exchange a slightly puzzled look. "At any rate, the temple was never built," said Rohan. "At various times, one or another of us has given thought to building a retreat up here, but that's never come to pass either." "We believe Grandpa would want you to have it," Iki concluded. "After all, you're among his next life's dearest friends." Utrina's smile had a dimension it wouldn't have had the day before, as she replied sincerely, "Well, I think I can speak for all of us when I say we're deeply honored, and very grateful, to accept your gift. This is beyond generous. You've all done so much for us in the last few days already." "Great Uncle Sokka once said that if a man doesn't have his family, he has nothing. Hiki said cheerfully, which didn't really seem to be a reply at first. To her distinct pleasure, Utna got there before Anthy for once, giving the airbender a sage little smiling nod a full second ahead of her wife. "Well, son, what do you say?" Rio asked Corwin, clapping him on the shoulder. "I brought my tools. Let's survey this bad boy." "No time like the present," Corwin agreed, nodding. "Rohan, Iki, Utna does speak for us in this, I think, but let me just add my own thanks anyway. This is amazing." "And mine as well," Anthy added with an earnest nod. With gracious goodwill all around, Rohan and Iki pitched in to help Rio and Corwin perform a full survey under Garnet's aerial supervision, complete with a set of topographical scans that could later be converted into a holographic mock-up of the entire site, suitable for construction planning. Utna and Anthy sat down on a boulder by the lakeshore and gazed out at the waterfall, smiling at their private thoughts. Presently, both were roused from their parallel reveries as Annabelle stirred, waking from a nap, and began diligently investigating Utna's shirt front. Anthy watched closely, a little smile playing at her lips, to see how her husband would react. To her delight, Utna's response, once she looked down and twigged to what the infant was doing, was to grin wryly and say, "Nope, sorry, kiddo. Barking up the wrong tree there." She reached to her waist and began to untie the knot of her air acolyte wrap. "Himemia, I believe this is your department." Anthy smiled, both at the mirth in Utna's voice and the evidence it represented of a better, easier frame of mind. "I believe it is," she said. Just as they were finishing up the transfer, with the sash in the same configuration, Corwin arrived. He smiled at the sight of Utna in pit crew mode, making sure, as Jinora had for her, that the knot was secure and all the folds and pleats correct. Once all was arranged to specifications, Anthy moseyed off along the lakeshore, talking quietly to Annabelle about how lovely their home was going to be while they took care of business. "I guess you are feeling better," said Corwin with a smile as he and Utna stood by the rock and watched their combined figure recede. "Yeah," Utna agreed. "I don't know as I'm completely done adjusting yet, but it's a lot less..." She considered her phrasing for a second. "Up on top of me than it was last night." She leaned against him, looping an arm around his waist. "I told Annabelle on the way out here, I'm not the mothering kind, but you might be right about the dad thing," she said wryly. Corwin chuckled and leaned down slightly to kiss her. "I'm glad to hear it. Like I told you yesterday morning, I think you'll be good at it." He looked around for a moment, making certain that the survey team didn't need him just now, which they didn't. Iki and Rohan had taken Rio up on Peavey to get a comprehensive aerial scan. Then turned back to Utna, his arm around her shoulders, and said, "While we've got a minute to ourselves, I have something for you." Utna raised her eyebrows. "Oh?" Corwin nodded. "Do you remember when we met Cora's cousin Kemba at the market? She gave you something to give to me." "I've been wondering about that," said Utna with a smile. "I assumed it had something to do with the thing she was giving you a hard time about." "It did," Corwin confirmed. "She thought I might be from the North Pole. See, in the water tribes, it's traditional for a man who hopes a woman will marry him to make a special kind of necklace for her. He carves the necklace with a unique design that identifies it as his work. If she accepts it and wears it, that's an announcement to everyone who sees her that she's chosen him." "Nice," said Utna. "More personal than a diamond ring." "Yeah, the water tribes are big on that," Corwin said. "Historically, they haven't had much in the way of material wealth, There aren't a lot of resources on the ice caps, so they make up for it with a lot of personal investment in the things they make. Utrinna considered certain of her own possessions that had been made by Corwin's hands, and her smile became a little sentimental. "I can see where that's an ethic that would appeal to you," she said. "Probably at least partly where I got it," he agreed. "Anyway, that being the case..." He unfastened one of the top pockets of his wool jacket, reached into it, and removed a small item, then took a step away and turned fully to her, so that he could offer it on an open palm. "I don't expect you to wear it, but I hope you will accept it," he said with a little smile. Across his palm lay a length of blue fabric about an inch wide, the same rich royal blue as the Water Tribe blanket Utrinna had bought from Kemba on that same visit to the Railway Square Market. Affixed to the middle of it was a circular piece of some finely translucent gemstone, similar to the brooch Utrinna remembered on the formal dress Cora had been wearing at their wedding, like a piece of smooth, pale blue ice. This had been carefully carved and polished, its edge notched into a bas-relief of gear teeth. The center, slightly convex, was crossed by the same circled lightning bolt symbol Beldandi had painstakingly drawn on Utrinna's forehead for both wedding attempts. She took it up and examined it closely, a broad smile coming onto her face, then closed her fist around it and hugged him tight, saying quietly, "Corwin, it's beautiful. Thank you." "You're welcome, Utrinna," he replied, returning the hug just as tightly. "I'm glad you like it." "Show me how you put it on," she said, and while Corwin was reasonably sure she could have figured that out for herself, he certainly didn't mind complying. Quickly and deftly, he snugged the necklace gently around her slender throat, choker fashion, and tied the ribbon in a flat bow knot at the back, so that the gem was centered in front. "There," she said with a satisfied smile, touching the gem with her fingertips. "Now I'll at least look like an honest woman to Kemba and Cora," she added with a slightly wicked grin. Back in town, Anne Cross spent the morning training with Azana in a corner of the Zuko Academy's vast main dojo. This was the first time they had done that, instead of going up to the roof or meeting in one of the practice gyms at Shiro Shinobi Arena. It was Anne's first real experience with communal training at all. Her studies with Caitlin were necessarily one-on-one now that Kate's other student had gone walkabout. And even before he had done, Kyuichi Sionji had not exactly been a crowd. Of course, they weren't all training together, strictly speaking. The other students and their instructors were scattered around the huge room in little groups, ranging from pairs like Azana and Anne, up to clusters of four or five, and each group was pursuing its own agenda. Still, all being at work in this same space conveyed a sense of community that Anne hadn't really felt before while training in a martial art. She quite liked it, at least as a change of pace. She would never want to trade her solo sessions with Azana for training in here all the time, but as a special occasion kind of thing, it worked. On the downside, one of those other instructors was Deng, and he would occasionally take a moment out from berating his students in slightly shrill drill instructor Tong Yu to give Azana and her student a baleful glower. But that meant nothing in the grand scheme of things, and Anne found herself fairly well able to tune him out most of the time. She was much more interested in what Ito-sensei and Caitlin-sensei were making of it. They, in turn, were making a great show of not observing, though both Anne and Azana knew very well that they were. The two masters, with Sergei sprawled at their feet, were sitting at a pie show table in the very back of the corner where their students were training, pretending to be so engrossed in their game that they were paying no attention at all. Anne's developing Zanshin, though, told her plainly that her every move was being scrutinized, and Azana clearly had a similar sort of facility. Such was the rapport that they had developed between them, to boot, that each knew the other was aware of it without asking. All in all, a very nice set of feelings, even marred by the occasional searchlight beam sweep of Deng's disapproval. "All right, very good," said Azana, squaring up to trade bows and firebender salutes with her student. "You're coming along in great bounds, Junichan," she went on, smiling. "It won't be long before you're taking my place on the fire ferrets." "Don't lay it on too thick," Caitlin cautioned her with a grin. "She still needs to be able to get her head through doors." Anne gave a self-deprecating laugh. "Ha! No, Sensei, I'm okay. I know she's only joking." "Perhaps," said Ito. "But I have to say I'm also impressed. You do learn quickly, and I can sense your respect for the craft. It's a rare thing in someone who comes to it as late as you have." He smiled. "I'm satisfied. If you wish to return this summer and train with Azana, you'll be most welcome. I may even take it upon myself to show you a trick or two, if your Sifu doesn't object to an old man's meddling," he added, his smile becoming a grin. "That depends on whether they're firebending tricks," said Azana wryly, "or your infamous practical jokes. I'm not having that." Ito laughed. "I suspect this young lady could come up with pranks of her own that would leave my feeble repertoire in the shade," he said, giving Anne a wink. "I don't know what you mean, Ito-sensei," Anne replied with unconvincing piety. Azana smiled fondly at the pair of them. "Right, you. Let's hit the showers and get some lunch before Grandfather corrupts you further," she said, tagging Anne's shoulder. Ito and Caitlin watched them pass through the side door to the ladies' changing room, then turned to each other and smiled. "Cora was right to send you here," said Ito. "She'll be a credit to my granddaughter's name." "I hope so," said Caitlin. "Shall we go in search of lunch ourselves?" "Let's have one more game before we go," said Ito. Kate considered that, then nodded. "Very well." Ito sat back in his chair. "It's your turn to make the first move," he said. So it is." Kate considered the tiles for a moment, then picked one up and placed it in the exact center of the board. Ito raised an eyebrow. He said. "I see you favor the White Lotus Gambit." After spending a couple of hours surveying, examining, considering, reflecting upon, and just generally enjoying the sight on Mount Wei Tang, the party broke up and returned to town by two different routes. Rohan and Corwin ran Ryo home on Peavey, then went into the city proper to register the transfer of ownership formally at the Republic City Land Office. Iki, meanwhile, saw Uchna, Anthy, Annabelle, and Garnet safely back to the island on Mogi, though to her glee, Uchna got to drive. Or at least sit there looking like she was in charge, while Mogi found his own way home, which she acknowledged was probably closer to the truth. Corwin and Rohan ate lunch in town after completing their errand. During the meal, Corwin had a curious encounter which he would not entirely understand for some time. He was still mulling it over in the back of his mind when he returned to Air Temple Island. After making certain Mogi had been unsaddled and returned to the Bison Caves when Uchna and company got in, which of course he had, Corwin poked around the island a bit, but found no sign of Nall. He would have liked to get the dragon's take on the strange conversation he'd had over lunch. Besides which, he knew they would have to discuss his confrontation with Lakpa sooner or later. He'd been hoping to get to it before Nall had a chance to hear about it from her and form a solid opinion, but it was what it was. Truth to tell, he was a bit weary of the whole business anyway, so he gave up after a single sweep around the dragon's usual haunts on the island, and returned to the house instead. There he found Utrina and Anthy, under Jinora's supervision, in the front room, experimenting some more with the length of silk that had so summarily defeated him that morning. Not very to his surprise, it seemed Utrina had decided to attempt the alternate configuration Jinora had described as an advanced technique, though at the point in the process where Corwin came in, she appeared to be regretting her rashness very slightly. "You're spotting me, right? I don't want to drop her," she said, glancing hesitantly back over her shoulder at Anthy. Anthy nodded. "Of course I am. We're not terribly practiced at this yet, any of us." "Oh, I can't watch," said Garnet, but she kept watching. "Relax, Garnet. Nothing will go wrong. Have faith," said Jinora sagely. "Okay, here goes then." Utrina tucked the fabric up, looping one end over her back and shoulder and the other around Annabelle and her own chest. She bent down and, with Anthea's help, scooted the baby high up onto her back, keeping the fabric as taut as she dared. "You can snug it tighter, dear," Anthy said from behind her. "She doesn't seem to mind." Utrina glanced at Jinora, who nodded slightly with a little smile. Thus reassured, she pulled the sash's long edges, rails, to use Jinora's word, more, until the fabric felt like it didn't have any more give. "Corwin, give her a hand with the next part, won't you? While Anthy keeps everything steady," Jinora prompted. Under her direction, they got everything wrapped up and tied securely, using a general technique very like the one she'd learned that morning. With everything folded and knotted just so, Utrina found that Annabelle was situated neatly between her shoulder blades, with the child's head resting on her, Utrina's, shoulder, and the whole rig felt snug and tight and very, very well balanced. "Say," she said, "that's not bad." After walking around in a little circle and testing the range of her shoulders, largely unimpeded, she tried an experimental lunge. Annabelle made a faint noise of approval, squirmed just slightly, and hiccuped. "I think I could probably even spar wearing her like this," said Utrina, blinking in surprise at Anthy. "Wow, this is actually pretty comfortable." "I'm pretty sure she'd enjoy it if you did, actually," Corwin said, then grinned. "I'm told I loved bouncing around on Mom's back while she was training with the Valkyrie back in the day." "Somehow I'm not surprised," Anthy said wryly. "Once you're more used to her, love, by all means, wear her through your workouts. As she grows, you'll get some extra leg strength from the added weight. And as long as you don't think she'll slip, she should be fine."
"I'll check with Caitlin," Utrina agreed. "She can keep an eye on her, too, and we can stop if anything slips."
She tried another lunge, deeper this time, and laughed at the cheerful sound it elicited from the baby.
"You like that, eh?"
she said, turning her head to catch Annabelle's face in the corner of her eye. "Want to go for a little run? Maybe check out the view from the meditation pavilion? Come on, Corwin, you can spot me. Let's give this rig a proper test."
"Not without me, you don't," Garnet objected, darting after them.
This from a woman who said yesterday that she wasn't sure how to react, Jinora observed dryly when the four had gone.
"That's our Utrina," said Anthy with a smile.
"Her engine room telegraph has only one setting. Damn the torpedoes." Jinora nodded.
Yes. I begin to understand why she and Cora have taken to one another so quickly."
They came back together at dinner, those who had ventured into town and those who had gone for experimental jogs, everyone but Nall, who remained curiously absent, and the sisters, who sat at opposite ends of the main table with the rest of the airbenders and paid as little attention to each other as possible.
This gave the occasion a slightly frosty undertone for those conscious of the subtext, but no one else seemed to notice. Most were too busy cooing over Annabelle, who, freshly cleaned, fed, and securely affixed to her mother, was making her debut at Cora's table. Caitlin and Anne arrived a little late, the latter a trifle singed. This gave people a new thing to exclaim over, though she turned aside their concerns as gracefully as she could. "I'm fine, it's nothing," she said. "Training accident?" Rory wondered, examining her scorched cheek. As always, he looked decidedly unmedical, a teenage boy in dockers, sneakers, and an unzipped hoodie over an old T-shirt emblazoned with an outdated Sirius Cybernetics Corporation slogan, "Your plastic pal who's fun to be with." In spite of his perpetual need of a shave, he was obviously little, if any, older than the girl whose injury he was inspecting. But word of his calm competence in attending Annabelle's birth had spread, and Anne was prepared to take his credentials as a matter of faith. If Anthe and Utrina believed he was a doctor, that was good enough for her. She shook her head. "No," she said. "Sifu Azana and I had a little, problem at lunch." "Not with each other, I hope," Amy put in, a bit startled. "Oh, no, no," Anne hastened to assure her. "No, we're..." She smiled a little abstractly. "We're great. No, this was a third party. I probably shouldn't say any more. The police are looking into it." Cora arrived then, striding over to the table with a purposeful frown. "Anne, are you all right?" she asked without preamble. "I'm fine," Anne repeated, looking both pleased and a bit exasperated at all the attention. "Really, it doesn't even hurt." "I take it you heard?" Caitlin inquired. Cora nodded. "I just came from the scene," she said. "Eitaro and I were having lunch with Emily when he got the call. Is what dispatch told him true? The man who attacked you was hopped up on Comet?" Anne shrugged slightly. "Well, I'm no expert," she qualified, "but he was hopped up on something. And technically he didn't attack me, he attacked Azana-sensei." She indicated her most visible burn and added ruefully, "I got this from falling rubble." "It's not very serious," Rory agreed, "but I'd still like to get a little Dermatrex on it after dinner, just to be on the safe side." "I'm not going to argue with that," said Anne. Then, taking a closer look at him, she noticed the jaunty American Civil War head bandage he was sporting, and asked, "What happened to you?" Amy giggled. "Girls 21, boys 7, she said. Despite her serious mood, Cora couldn't help but snicker at that. "Nice," she said, bumping fists with the young Scotswoman. Then she turned her attention back to Anne. "Did you give the investigating officer at the scene a statement?" she asked. Anne nodded. "I didn't see most of the actual fight. I was too busy trying to keep the block from burning down." "Well, from what I saw, it looked like you did a pretty good job," said Cora with a distracted smile. "Inspector Imanishi will want to get a more detailed account from you. It's a Comet incident, so his task force is taking over the case." "Aren't you guys leaving tomorrow?" "That was the plan," Kate confirmed. "We're both supposed to be in New Avalon first thing on Monday." Cora thought that over, then nodded. "I'll see if I can get him to come out and talk to you tonight, then, just to get that loose end tied up before you leave town." "Okay," Anne agreed. Then she smiled crookedly and added, "I'm not used to being so comfortable about talking to the police." Cora chuckled. "Well, Itaro's a sweetheart. You won't have any problems with him. He just wants to make sure the record is as complete as it can be. You're certainly not in any trouble." Well, that's good to hear, said Anne. At the far end of the main table, Lakpa ate her dinner as quickly as she could, then excused herself and slipped quietly away. No one seemed interested in her departure. The youngsters were wrapped up in their own matters, the elders as well, and Nima had done an extremely convincing job of acting as though she hadn't noticed her sister was even in the room throughout the meal. She found Nall exactly where she'd left him, exactly where he'd been all day long, on the topmost level of the Air Temple's tower, gazing meditatively out not at the Republic City skyline, but rather at the jagged mountain peaks to the north of the city. He didn't seem to hear her coming up through the trap door, only when she slipped up behind him and put her arms around him, her hands sliding across his chest, did he acknowledge her presence, raising a hand to grip one of her wrists gently. "Hey," he said. "You've been up here all day," Lakpa pointed out, entirely unnecessarily. "Why?" she wondered. "What are you looking at over there?" "The mountains," Nall told her. "They remind me of a lot of things. Draconia and Hyrule." He sighed. "Where your last girlfriend was from," said Lakpa. "Where I lost her," Nall replied. Lakpa held him a little tighter and asked quietly, "Do you wish she was here now?" "Not really," said Nall, squeezing her wrist a little in response. Then he added wryly, "If she was, and she saw us like this, there'd probably be a god-awful fight." Lakpa snorted. "That's not what I meant." "I know, I was dodging the question," said Nall matter-of-factly. Then, before she could press the matter further, if indeed she planned to, he took a deep, slow breath and said, "I dreamed about Nax last night. He wanted to know if I had enjoyed killing him. If I understood yet that a real dragon would have." "Nall, stop it," said Lakpa. "Just stop it. Dragons don't have to be cruel. You should read Avatar Roku's book about his travels with Fang. They were best friends all of their lives." "Wasn't Roku's other best friend Fire Lord Sozin?" Nall asked skeptically. "That doesn't really recommend him as a judge of character." He sighed. "I'm sorry, Lakpa. I know you're trying to help." He turned around in her arms, so he was facing her, and put his hands on her shoulders. "I'm not very good company today. Maybe you should go hang with the rest of the crew instead. They're heading back in the morning." Lakpa glanced away. "I don't think that would be such a good idea," she said. "Corwin's pretty mad at me right now." Nall quirked an eyebrow. "Why?" She told him about both her prank on Nima the night before and her defensive reaction to Corwin's displeasure with it in the morning. "Oh," said Nall. He took another deep breath. "Yeah, I can see where that would tick him off. Twice, even. Once because you were mean to Nima, and once because you copped an attitude when he called you on it." "I know," Lakpa said, resting her head on his shoulder. "It's been nagging at me all day. I didn't want to admit he's right, but he kind of is. I mean, everything I told him was true, but..." She sighed. "It's not Nima's fault she's so damned perfect. She just is. The spirits favor some people. It doesn't do any good to envy them for it." Nall chuckled wryly. "Nima's probably telling herself the same thing about you." "Me?" Lakpa stepped back to regard him quizzically. "What in the world would she envy about me? She's smarter, stronger, a better airbender than I'll ever be. Graceful, confident. The one thing I've got that she hasn't is my looks, and Nima doesn't care about appearances.
She knows she shouldn't care about appearances, Nall corrected her. But sometimes we can't help ourselves.
Hmm, said Lakpa, as though the possibility had never occurred to her before.
I mean, you know better than to get attached to me, but here we are, Nall went on.
Here we are, Lakpa agreed, and kissed him. At least until tomorrow.
Actually, I think I'll stay, said Nall.
Lakpa looked pleasantly surprised.
Really?
Not right here, he qualified, but in Dicho. Maybe I'll see if I can find a proper dragon peak over there, he added, gesturing to the mountains that were now behind him. Stop pretending to be a man for a while and see where that gets me. With a sardonic grin, he added, You can come visit when you get your bison license. Venture into my lair and risk your monastic chastity.
Bah, she said, I only dress like a monk. And she kissed him again.
After their own dinner, the rest of the visitors and Cora retired to the parlor of Tenzin's house for a low-key last evening of team togetherness. Those who hadn't made the trip to Mount Weitang oohed and aahed over the photos Corwin and Ryo had taken. All agreed that it was going to be a dynamite place for a vacation home.
The hard part's going to be access to the site, Corwin observed, looking over one of the aerial shots they'd taken upon departing.
We'll either have to build some kind of a road or bring everything in by air. Either option could get complicated.
Well, Cora mused, a rough construction road is just a matter of a few days to a week with an earthbending team. Anything more refined than that, you'll have to go to the Road Builders Union, and probably the Republic DOT, if you want it to tie into the public roads. The planning office probably has some information on that. You should check with Chin. He'll know who you should be talking to over there.
Corwin nodded. Man, he declared, shaking his head and flipping through a couple more of the images. Wish I had a couple more weeks, at least, to really get started on this. He looked up from a panorama of the falls and grinned at her. It's exciting.
Actually, Cora and I were talking about this last night, said Utena. Why don't we? I mean, we haven't got anything really pressing to rush back to, have we?
She gestured to her wife, who was giving her an interested look, and went on, Anthea and I don't have to be back at NIT until the fall semester starts, and you're pretty much completely at liberty, Corwin.
And that being the case, Cora added, why don't you guys stay a while longer? Stay right through the summer if you want.
We can actually build the house, Utena declared. People can come visit us once their spring semesters and whatnot end. It'll be good times.
She picked up the nearest book and gestured with it. We are grown-up people with a child and everything, and we can do whatever we darn well want. It says so right here in the handbook.
That's my copy of Love Amongst the Dragons, Kate pointed out with a little smile.
Details, Utena replied.
Corwin's grin widened.
You're not going to get any argument out of me, he said cheerfully.
Then, his brow furrowing, he went on, Although, no Valiant summer tour this year?
Kate gave him a lovingly indulgent look.
Did you think I've been planning on one this whole time, knowing there'd be a newborn in the captain's family? She said, reaching out to ruffle Lutina's hair.
That'd be pretty optimistic, even by our standards. We can find something else to do with ourselves for a summer.
We have got rock and roll in Dicho, you know, Cora pointed out with a grin. Alternate reality world tour, anyone?
Kate laughed.
I bet the guys would love it. We've never done a proper one-planet world tour, and it's always fun to break in new audiences.
Oh, man, said Anne. Do you think Dicho is ready for Ezzelin?
She's been here before, Caitlin said. Nobody went to jail, although admittedly it was only the one time.
Anthy, you haven't had much to say, said Uchna. What do you think?
Anthy smiled. I've just been enjoying all your reactions, she said. I think it's a fine idea. So long as Jinora doesn't mind us staying in her house a while longer. I wouldn't want to overstay our welcome.
Oh, don't worry about that, Korra assured her. I ran it by her while you were all up checking out Mount Weitang this morning. She likes you guys. Particularly you, Anthy, she added with a grin. You'd better watch yourself. If you stay here all summer, she's liable to try and recruit you.
Anthy chuckled. It'd be an honor, she said. With that, the Trinity started discussing the particulars of extending their stay, trying to anticipate anything that might need doing either back in the big universe or in Sephiro in the next few months. Getting back and forth wouldn't be a particular problem, nor would communications, but it would be important for people to know where to find them if there were issues, and there were a few logistical matters that needed handling. They'd only packed for a few days, for instance. While they were working on sorting all that out, there came a knock at the door, and Korra got up from where she'd been lounging against Neri's side to admit a middle-aged gentleman in a crumpled gray suit and overcoat.
"Hey, Taro, come on in," she said, gesturing him inside. "Meet my new team. Everyone, this is Inspector Imanishi. You've heard me talk about him."
She introduced him around. Imanishi greeted everyone politely, bowing to all, and then asked if he might have another word with Miss Cross before she left his jurisdiction.
"Of course," she said, rising. "Let's go to the front room."
Imanishi's manner, once they were settled in armchairs in the front room, was calm, affable, and soothing, putting her immediately at ease. "Let me just assure you again, Miss Cross, you're not in any trouble," he said while he got out his notebook. "Far from it. By Fire Marshal Kaziro's estimate, your actions most likely saved a half dozen buildings, and perhaps three times as many lives today."
Anne felt herself blushing slightly. She glanced away, grinning crookedly, and said, "Well, I'm just glad I could help."
"You certainly did. There's no doubt about that. And it is a thing you shouldn't hesitate to be proud of. I know that the temptation is always there to assume that no good deed will go unpunished," he added with a small smile. "But we try not to operate that way in Republic City." Opening his notebook, he went on, "Now let's just go over what you saw and heard one more time, and I'll let you get back to your evening." It took Imanishi only about 10 minutes to take a second statement from his witness, since her initial statement had been very comprehensive and his few follow-up questions were direct and easily answered. At the end, he rose and closed his notebook, saying, "Well, thank you, Miss Cross. I think that's all I need from you. I'm sorry this happened. I hope it won't color your impression of our city too badly."
Anne gave her crooked smile again. "I wouldn't worry about that," she said. "Even given this afternoon, I think there's a lot more good than bad in Republic City. Believe me, I've seen so much worse."
Imanishi smiled. "I'm pleased to hear it," he said. "Not that you've seen worse, but that you find Republic City agreeable in spite of your experience today." Tucking his notebook away in his coat, he bowed to her. "Have a safe journey home. I understand you're planning to return in the summer?"
"That's the plan," Anne confirmed, standing to return his bow with a firebender salute.
"Probably in early June. Do you think I'll need to come back before then to testify at the trial? I can if I have to, but I'll need a little advance warning." Ibanishi's face was solemn, as he shook his head and replied slowly, "I doubt there will be a trial, Miss Cross." Anne looked a bit troubled when she returned alone to the sun parlor, but no one noticed. The mood was dispelled almost instantly, anyway, by the sight that greeted her when she arrived. Neri had shifted her position, sprawling on her side and taking up most of the floor space between the futon daybed and the sofa. Serge had positioned himself alongside the futon, more or less at right angles, so that the two lay almost nose to nose, and both were dozing contentedly while their mistresses brushed them. "Look at all these orange hairs," Cora remarked, scraping her brush. "People are going to talk, girl." "They do make a gene mod that would turn his orange parts white," Kate said cheerfully, "but then you'd still have the black ones to deal with." She looked up and smiled at Anne. "All set?" Anne nodded. "No problems," she said. "And at this moment, in this room full of friends and love," she meant it.